Yes.
How did you get started in all this? How did you such a strong interest?
Good question about how I got started. The question was about how I got started in this business. I guess I would call it, in a way, a historical accident. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I was unemployed, and I was browsing for places to work, and I came across their website, and I said, that looks interesting. And I called them up, and I said, can I come in for an informational interview? I just want to learn about kind of the stuff that you're working on. And they said, well, we actually have a job position open for someone in our energy program. Would you like to interview for it? And I said, sure, why not? I took one class on that in grad school. And they were willing to take a chance on me. So it's been a lot of on-the-job training is how I've been in this, and very little background before that.
Who are the funders? Who is funding this?
Sure, a question about who funds our work at the Institute. We are mostly a foundation grant-funded organization. McKnight Foundation, Bush Foundation in Minnesota, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, there's quite a few other ones. If you would like, I'd be happy to send you our IRS Form 990, which will list all of our funders. Yes?
When did you originally graduate?
Oh, sure. Question about what degree I have. My undergraduate work was in political science and math. I went to the University of Minnesota for a master's in public policy. So I had an idea of how to do policy research and to write long papers on request. And converted that into a nice position for myself. Yeah.
In my understanding of Illinois is that most of the communities have a contract with the utility, and usually that gives a benefit to the city. Usually it's reduced free lighting, street lights, or something. But people. Right. Okay. My understanding of Illinois is that each community has a contract with the utility to supply power to that community. And from people that I knew on the Commerce Commission, when they said that most of the communities don't have the legal power, brain power, to negotiate a good contract. So, you know, it seems like to me that this might be an opportunity to develop that kind of expertise, that some nonprofit would offer that service to help negotiate these contracts with the utility. Now, do you know of any service like that or any service like that envisioned?
That's a very good question. That really is kind of that franchise contract concept that I was talking about. I guess what I would say about it is, no, I don't know of anything like that. I think there are going to be some very good resources that are generated out of this process that's going on in Minneapolis. A little bit of backstory there. It was basically a grassroots effort that grew up around that I was involved in with many other people. And we were initially agitating for the city council to put a city-owned utility on the ballot. And our argument was, we don't necessarily want the city to go out and try to do this right away, but we want them to have the leverage to demand more from the utility. And we got it anyway. I mean, we didn't get the ballot measure, but we did get some very serious negotiations. And what's likely to happen out of this is a fairly novel kind of utility and city partnership, where the utilities have said in writing that they are interested in helping the city meet its energy goals around both pollution emissions and clean energy development. I mean, Minneapolis is a big city. It's about 400,000 people, and they've got a legal department that can probably do a lot of this. And my hope is that the documents that come out of this, which will be public, will be some good templates for what could be used elsewhere. Yes?
What do you tell people who say, there's no way that wind could give us 500% of our power? How can that be when wind goes down at night? And where did you get your figures on that?
Those figures are from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. I actually took that map from a report I published in 2010 called Energy Self-Reliant States, if you want to find the footnotes on where those numbers come from. What I would say about that number is that it's what's called a technical potential number, which means on an annual basis, wind could provide over 500% of the electricity used. It's not an hourly comparison of the load and use in Illinois with the wind power production. I would have to say, I think that if you had five times as many wind turbines as you needed, you'd probably be okay. But obviously, it would be much more efficient to manage the grid in a different way, to have a mix of wind and solar, maybe some energy storage, probably in the near term, continue to have some natural gas power plants that can ramp up and down production very quickly to fill in the gaps. But there's actually I should mention too, there's a guy from Stanford, Mark Jacobson, who's been doing a lot of state-by-state analysis of how you would get that hourly load met by renewables. And he's saying essentially that you can do it 99.9% of the time from renewables only. It's really only a very small increment that you would need storage without building 500% of your need from wind power. So there's a lot of good research out there. And as I alluded to before, the resistance from the utility is there's sort of two things at work here. One is an economic problem where they've sunk a lot of money into power plants that they were hoping to continue to run 10, 20, 30, 40 more years profitably. And we're basically saying to them, shut them down. They're dirty. And we can also get electricity as cost effectively from renewables as you can from that power plant, even though it's already paid off. And so, and then the second piece, of course, you have going on is simply inertia, that the utilities are used to managing a grid that's in a one-way direction from their power plants to us. And this notion of managing two-way flows just seems very complicated to them. And all, I think the only thing I would say about it is, I don't think wireline telephone companies really imagined what cell phones would do to our telecommunications. I don't think the folks that were working on mainframe computers in the 1980s could have envisioned what the internet would have done in terms of information flow. The same thing can happen in a utility system. It doesn't have to be some sort of catastrophic upending of our economy. In fact, it can be something that can be very good for everybody. Yeah.
You seem to be an advocate of big wind, and I wonder how you answer the concerns of subsonic sound, blade flash, bat kill, eagle kill, and dewscape modification that opponents of big wind have brought up, and also wondering what you think about big wind versus like small wind, like 1 or 2 kilowatt machines, and geothermal as well.
All good questions about big wind and some of its drawbacks, about small wind, about geothermal. I'll take the big wind one first. There's sort of two answers to your question. I'll give you the facetious one first, which is to say there aren't a lot of community wind projects that have had a lot of local opposition on any of those grounds. And so I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that there is there's a disconnect between what our legal system allows us to contend around and what the real issue is at stake. I think a lot of communities look at this and say, you're essentially using our resource that's coming through our community, and you're profiting from it, and you're taking the profits out of our community. We'd love to contend with you on those grounds, but you get laughed out of court if you say, we think it's unjust that they're coming here and using our resource. On the other hand, you can make very good legal arguments around viewshed, around health effects, around environmental impacts, and so that's where the lawyers have gone. And so I think the problem that we have is that we have a structure and an incentive system around wind. I mean, the wind project I mentioned in South Dakota was sort of a historical accident. It happened because after the financial crisis, all of the big banks that had been bankrolling big wind projects using federal tax credits were losing money. And you don't need tax credits when you're not making any money anymore. And so the Congress responded by saying, we'll let you take it as a cash grant instead of a tax incentive for 2 years. And while that helped out all of the big players, it actually opened the door to community wind, because community folks didn't need a tax credit either. They weren't big banks that had millions of dollars to offset in investments. And so that community wind project was able to be developed because that cash grant allowed them to take literally cash instead of a tax credit, and allowed them to distribute that to the farmers and ranchers that invested in it. So there's a lot of different structural issues with how that goes. I'm an advocate for large-scale wind turbines, because it's simply the cost effectiveness of building tall is so enormous. The wind gets exponentially better the higher up you go. I have nothing against small wind turbines. They're great. And in fact, they're often, as I'm told by many of the small wind advocates, more cost effective than solar. So stop talking about just solar. But part of it too is that I come from an urban area, and a lot of the ferment around renewables is coming from urban areas where you can't do small wind very effectively, but you can do solar. So I hope that answers those two. As to geothermal, I'd refer you to some of the stuff that I've published on that, like the Energy Self-Reliant States Report. I think it's a great resource. It's especially good for commercial properties, like the ground source geothermal, and there's some great commercial opportunities for it in terms of utility scale out in the southwest, where the hot rocks are much closer to the surface. But I could bore you with details on that, but we'll leave that for another day. Yeah.
Where are we, and how are we coming with the development of very efficient batteries? A good number of years ago, Senator McCain said we ought to give some company, award of $300 million if they, if they win this contest about developing very good batteries that are very efficient, so you could store this wind and solar energy in certain ways. And I mean, you know, you can store oil and gas and everything else, except you can't store wind and solar.
Right.
Unless you have good batteries.
So good question about where are we at with batteries and battery storage for storing renewable energy. There's sort of two things to think about when we think about storage. A lot of folks think about energy storage as like the way that we use a battery for a laptop, where you store the energy with it and then you operate off the battery for a long period of time. Where batteries are actually particularly useful for the utility system is meeting that minute-to-minute variation in energy demand. There's no fossil fuel power plant, no matter how fast it can respond with natural gas or anything else, that can be as efficient as a battery in doing that. And so that's kind of the entree to batteries into the utility market right now. That's the opportunity for batteries right now, is meeting these very small variations in electricity demand very efficiently. And what that's going to do is create a market, a very fast growing market, for mass production of batteries. I mean, I guess what I'd say is we're getting there already. I have a chart in a report I published on energy storage earlier this year that shows the very steady decrease in battery prices. And the reason is that all these laptops and phones and everything else use lithium ion batteries, and we're making millions and millions of them every year.
Afghanistan and South America, Bolivia, so those two countries have most of this raw material. It's sort of I can't think of the name right now, that raw material.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are issues with where their rare metals come from.
Is it just all talk?
Well, I guess I'm going to come up with a brief answer to this, because this is a huge section in and of itself. Pardon? The question is sort of about where we get the raw materials for batteries. There's an issue with some of the batteries, like lithium for batteries, and the countries sometimes conflict-torn where we can get those minerals. There's sort of two answers to that. One is we're already making a lot of batteries from that material, so it's not the use for the energy grid that's going to make the difference. Those are definitely things we have to be cognizant of, and there's a lot of development of new battery technologies. Batteries are not going to be the only thing we use either. There are not only a lot of different battery technologies, but there are, we already use the world's biggest batteries are hydro dams, where we can pump water uphill when energy is cheap and pump it back downhill when we need that to tap into that energy. There are some other pretty crazy and fantastic ideas. One of them is to take 6 miles of railroad track, put a train on it, and fill it with gravel, and move it uphill with electricity when electricity is cheap and we have a surplus, and roll it downhill with regenerative braking, like we have in hybrid cars when we need energy. So you don't need that much land, and you can, just as long as you have a slope, you can store energy. Another one is actually just heating gravel. Gravel can actually hold a lot of energy as heat. You can use heat exchangers then to extract that at different times. I mean, there's a whole world out there, frankly, that we haven't tapped into because in the past we never saw a use for it. All utilities were managed in a one-way flow. They simply used different levels of quicker responding power plants to meet load, and energy storage was essentially hydro dams. So it's a completely new world. The next decade is going to be, remarkable for its ferment when it comes to energy storage.
In the same vein, Germany is doing a lot in storage and looking at getting away from, the nuclear and the coal fire. That's, I think, the big issue for everyone is how do we get there without, needing to invest in more traditional plants.
Sure. To answer the question, how do we get to where we need to go in terms of renewables without having to build more fossil fuel power plants or nuclear for that matter? And Germany being kind of an interesting illustration, in part because they have made a commitment to phase out nuclear power entirely. One of the important reasons that they're doing that, frankly, is, I mean, there's a very big environmental concern for them around nuclear ever since Chernobyl, and that's been underlying their politics for a long time. So that politics is different than is here in the U.S. But the other thing that's important to understand is that chart I showed you earlier about the stacking of the grid system, and maybe I'll go back to that really quick, is that, you know, these baseload power plants that run round the clock are not very flexible. And in a renewable energy grid, we're essentially going to flip the grid. Instead of looking at, here's the load curve that we have during the day, the amount of energy that we use as it goes up and down, in a primarily renewable energy system, we're going to say, here's how much renewable energy we have, and here's the gap between that and what we need. And we're going to need things that are very flexible to fill that in. So it might be batteries, and it could be natural gas, and it could be any of these other interesting things that we're coming up with. It could be gravel trains or whatever. But it really can't be coal and nuclear. We really can't have those as a component of a system that's primarily renewable because you can't ramp them up and down. You know, you can change the output of a nuclear power plant by a few percentage points over a day or two or a week. Nothing like what we're going to need in a primarily renewable system. And so, you know, the Germans are setting out and doing some very interesting things. One thing that they're looking at is using wind turbines to convert to create hydrogen as a backup fuel. You can pump it, you can use it as a fuel, like in a natural gas system for fleet vehicles. You can just store it in tanks and then burn it back through, with zero emissions when you do need backup power. So there's, like I said, there's just a huge amount of ferment and opportunity out there that's going to solve these technological problems, you know, long before we get to the, you know, we're at 8% renewable right now in the U.S. grid, maybe 6%. We've got plenty of time to figure the technical challenges out. Over here then, yes.
You keep referring to the fact that you get more information off of my website. What is your website?
Good question. It's ilsr.org, right there under Learn More. ilsr.org. I hope you can... Oh yeah, it's pretty dark up there, isn't it? Sorry about that. Yes, when I get back to work this week after I read 10,000 emails, I will be posting this presentation on our website, so you'll be able to find it there. And usually what I do when I put it up on the web is I'll add a few more words to actually describe the slides, since folks who read it there don't necessarily get the whole picture. Back here. Can you say that louder? Right, sorry.
What are some of the
Sure. The question is about some of the legal obstacles to local ownership. Sure. I have a presentation that's on the website called Five Barriers to Community-Owned Renewable Energy, which will explain all of that. But I guess what I would say is the reference I made earlier on about crowdfunding and the federal rules for investing have made it fairly complicated for how a bunch of people can invest in a renewable energy project that's not located on any of their property, because then it's considered an investment. There are rules for investments about who's allowed to invest and how much money they're allowed to put in, and kind of the audits and the compliance. Another really major barrier that's actually going to fade away simply because the economics continue to get better for renewables has been the fact that we use tax credits as our incentives instead of cash. You know, when I was talking about that South Dakota project, it couldn't have happened if we were under a regime where tax credits were the only tool that they could use for incentives. Not everybody can use a tax credit, frankly. It's kind of complicated sometimes to go through the filing for that. It's sort of this weird notion of, you know, let's say the project costs $10,000, I've got a $3,000 tax credit coming. How do I finance that $3,000? I don't want to really borrow that money for 10 years when I'm going to get it back in 6 months. There's had to be a lot of sort of financial innovation in banking about how to structure loans in order to deal with that. It means that cities, nonprofits, a lot of cooperatives can't own renewables or can't use those incentives, and there aren't comparable incentives for those entities. So, like I said, I'll refer you to that presentation for some of the other pieces of that, but those are some of the really big ones that have been in the way. And that's actually one of the nice things is at the end of 2016, the solar tax credit's going to expire, and the wind tax credit already expired. or will at the end of this year after a brief extension. I would prefer that they phase it out rather than just let it die, but in some ways we're better off going down the path of where those are not the barrier anymore, and we're looking at continuing to drive down the cost and how do we solve the issues of ownership for people rather than how do we make a tax credit work. Next tune, yeah. Doing local energy is the podcast. Most of the, and just so in case you are like me and don't want to sit down and listen to anything for even 15 minutes, I summarize them in a post. But most of the podcasts are interviews with people who have developed community-based renewable energy projects, and there's a good outline kind of the process they went through. You're welcome to contact me. I know most of these people personally and would be happy to connect you, and they're the kind of folks who would say, sure, I'd be happy to talk to someone who wants to work on this. Thank you very much.